The civil justice meeting will come to order, and Representative Olin moves the minutes of the February 16th meeting. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Okay, the first bill on the agenda is House File, we do have a quorum, House File 332, Representative Jackson. Mr. Dunleavy.
You know my guess.
Representative Jackson, you're on the committee. I assume you want to move your own bill.
Yes, I move House File number 332.
And Representative Jackson, this one, I believe, goes directly to the floor, doesn't it?
Does it?
To the general register. Okay, Representative Jackson moves House File 332 to go to the general register, and I see she has Mr. Dunleavy there. Do you want to just briefly go through it?
Sure.
After hearing you in Commerce, and it took, I think, 3 minutes in the Commerce Committee, the whole bill, so, including the vote.
Yeah, my lesson was my first appearance on this bill before a committee is that less is more. and so the summary overview is pretty accurate. It's pretty straightforward. It's really a housekeeping bill because last year a couple of important little things were left out of this otherwise wonderful transfer on death deed, and that is, letting the auditor's office in the various counties know where to send tax statements once the transfer has been completed by the death. And some other little things, but with me is Kevin Dunleavy, and between he and I think we can answer about any question about this bill.
Well, Representative Jackson, you lost one vote by calling it a wonderful bill, but Mr. Dunleavy, go ahead and state your name.
My name is Kevin Dunleavy, and I co-chair the Legislative Committee of the Real Property Section of the State Bar Association. And I'm available for questions, unless you want me to walk through the bill.
Can you walk through it in about a minute or less?
Pretty much. The Representative Jackson has already explained the transfer on death deed. That's to give the county auditor a place to send the tax statements when the affidavit proving up the death has been filed. Article 2 is to extend the benefits of common interest certificates of title to planned unit developments. It was formerly available for condominiums, and a planned unit development is a grouping of small houses with minimal distances between the houses. Would be less than what the normal case would be for single family dwellings, but the trade-off is that the development has an open area, a playground, and essentially a park to make up for the small sizes of the yards. They're used a lot for like starter homes, single parents, and those types of families. A condo is you own the inside of the box, and the condo unit, the condo association owns everything else. There's one certificate of title for the common areas for condo properties, and now with this, for planned unit development, there would be just one certificate of title for the common areas. So that's a long explanation, but it's a fairly simple concept. Article 3, designated transfers. I'm on page 9, line 9.10. Presently, designated transfers are exempt from deed tax because they're not considered to be a sale. A designated transfer is, I own the property, I create a single member LLC, and I transfer the property to my LLC. There's no change in the beneficial ownership of that property, so there isn't a deed tax other than the minimal deed tax of $1.65. And the county auditors don't consider that to be a arm's length sale for purposes of comparable sales for determining assessments, so they don't really care. The revenue department is okay with this, that there wouldn't be a certificate of real estate values and those types of transfers. Section 3, 2 years ago, the legislature extended to municipalities the ability to create cartways. Cartways are roads that are two rods, 33 feet wide, That's so that a landlocked parcel can get access to a public road. It's kind of a mini condemnation process. The property owner gets paid compensation determined by the local government. But when that ability was given to municipalities, the procedure wasn't given. So all this does is give the same procedures for municipalities that townships have. The only question I've had on this is, could you put in a shopping mall with this type of road? And the answer is no. This is intended to benefit single-family dwellings. The roads aren't wide enough for commercial development.
Well, I'd like to add that a change we made, an oral amendment, was at the request of the League of Minnesota Cities, and that is 9.21. Originally, I think we referred to a city clerk, but because various sizes of cities result in there being either a city clerk, a city administrator, or a city manager, it was requested, and we agreed that we would change that to chief appointed city officer. And I just state that to let you know that the League of Minnesota Cities, at least with this bill, in this body, is fine with that language and fine with the bill as a whole.
Okay, the last is section 4 of Article 3 on 9.25. This eliminates the need to have an affidavit of attorney in fact when it's a corporation that has the affidavit, or excuse me, that has the power of attorney. And the concept behind that is that corporations don't die, and the main purpose of the affidavit is to prove up that the person that has the power of attorney hasn't died. Because, excuse me, when the principal dies, the power is extinguished. So, like, for example, my mom gave my dad a power of attorney before she died to take care of her affairs. When she died, the power of attorney went poof. With the corporations don't die, and so there really isn't a need to prove up that the corporation is still alive, like there is with an individual. And this actually will make it a lot easier to clear titles, because it's almost impossible to get these kinds of affidavits from big corporations, especially out-of-state corporations, when you're doing real estate transactions.
Okay, very complicated and controversial bill. Is there any questions or comments? Okay, then Representative Jackson renews her motion to pass House File 332 and send it to the General Register. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carried.
All right, the next bill we have for consideration is House File 497, and Representative Mullery, would you like to move your bill to get it before the committee?
So moved.
Okay, we have the bill before us. Representative Mullery, please present your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is another very controversial bill. Those of you who were on the committee last year remember that this started out with different language in a different section of the law, and we had Joe Olson from the, and I'm not sure of the exact name, but the Gun Owners Association, and they came in, we worked out a deal with them, and everybody was happy. It passed unanimously from the House, got to conference committee, and the Senate said they didn't understand it and wouldn't take it. So we're just going to send it back and hope they understand it this time. Basically what this does is it allows the probation authorities, when they have to go into somebody's home, they can find out whether that person that they're going into their home has an application or a permit for a gun. And it's pretty obvious if you have to go into somebody's home because it's part of your duty as a probation officer, you want to have access to that. And we have Cal Sari, I'm not sure of the technical, I know he's in charge, head of the probation agents in this state, and
maybe you can just give a few words on it.
Good morning. Welcome to the committee, and please state your name.
Good morning. Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Mulry. My name is Kelvin Fari. I'm the legislative liaison for the Minnesota Corrections Association. This particular bill has been a position that probation officers and parole officers throughout the state of Minnesota have been seeking for several years. And as Representative Mulry indicated, a few years back we got into some gun control issues, and it really shouldn't be that big of an issue. It's rather a data privacy thing. Last year, this committee did pass that legislation, and it got tied up in conference committee and kind of lost again, so we're back again looking for it. The Minnesota Corrections Association does present a legislative agenda. As members of this committee, you have all received this, but if you don't have it, I do have copies here if anybody would like to look at it. But page 7 of that document does outline our position as an association in advocating this legislation. As Representative Mulry indicated, there are two primary purposes for this. First of all, is a matter of officer safety. We have probation officers doing intensive supervision who are going into the community, knocking on doors late at night, and just having the availability of the knowledge of knowing who retains permits would kind of give them a heads up on critical situations within the community. So it does become an officer safety thing, but more importantly than that, the primary item of that is, as you would all know, probation officers are responsible for doing pre-sentence investigations. The Citizens Personal Protection Act requires the revocation of gun permits for people convicted of certain crimes. Since probation officers are doing a pre-sentence investigation, it would be imperative that we be able to have access to that material so it could be contained in a part of the pre-sentence investigation, and the judge could become aware of that and make sure that it's in the sentencing minutes as such. So essentially those are the two reasons why we kind of advocate this bill. We also have Steve Dornback here as a retired corrections person from Ramsey County who has been advocating for this for several years, and I allow him to make a few comments.
Thank you. Good morning. Welcome to the committee, and please state your name.
My name is Steve Dornbach, and I'm a member of the Legislative Committee of the Minnesota Corrections Association. And as Cal indicated, I've been retired for a few years, 48 years active with the corrections field. And as Cal indicated, we've been looking to get this passed so that corrections, probation, parole, so forth, can deal with their own clients, and that's what it's restricted to, so that they could contact the public safety who keeps a database of who these people are that have permits, and if they have committed particularly a felony type offense, then the court can then deal with them on that. Thank you.
Is there any further discussion? Representative Holbert.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Mulry, or your testifiers, is it your intent that parole and county probation authorities may only access the records of those individuals that are assigned to them?
Representative Mulry?
Madam Chair?
Yes, sir.
It apparently is their intent. Madam Chair, Representative Holbert, actually when we worked this out with Mr. Olson, I think it was last year, that was not the issue. He was okay with whether or not they were assigned to him. What he was objecting to was getting this for somebody else. In other words, like if I was over at Kate's house, that they couldn't do it for run a check on Kate. That was what the issue was.
Madam Chair and Representative Mulry, I'm trying to figure out, it talks about that it doesn't say that's assigned to them. It doesn't say that's part of their caseload or whatever in your bill, number one. And number two, the other concern is, will there be a record of this, that information was requested? In other words, so the individual can find out how information about them is being used.
Representative
Mulry. Representative Solberg, Madam Chairman. the, I suppose, and similar to probation when they're doing a PSI, contacting public safety for a record check, it would be a similar thing on doing this, getting, this would be asked for also. But I'm not sure how the client themselves would know, or, yeah. And by the way, your question before was just clients of probation or parole that we're dealing with.
And Madam Chair and Representative Mullery, would Representative Holbrook be agreeable to some additional language in your bill that would make that clear?
Madam Chair,
Representative Mullery,
what he just said, whatever language is, will do that.
All right, and I think it can be done, Madam Chair, pretty easily with a couple of words, and I don't know if Mr. Gearing's up for it now or if you want to, is this going to the floor or?
Yeah.
No, Committee on Safety Policy and Oversight.
Yeah, does it go to that?
Yeah,
oh, okay.
Safety Policy and Oversight. And then, Madam Chair, given it's a Chapter 13 issue, is it going to be... Are you having a data practices group? Are you going to have a bill or...
Madam Chair, it'll probably have to come back from Representative Hilstrom's committee back to this committee for the data
practices. All right. Madam Chair, in the interest of time, the rest of the committee, I'll just hold off and work with Chair Mullery and see if we can get some clarifying language into the bill.
All right. Thank you. Representative Scott. Thank you, Madam Chair. My question is, I'm sorry, I don't remember your name, the former parole officer. I'm assuming that this bill is for safety purposes for the officers that are going to be approaching these doors and not knowing what's behind on the other side. Is that the primary purpose of the bill, would you say? Because my concern is that you're probably already prepared knowing that anything could be on the other side of that door when you knock on it, and whether or not these people... you know, have a gun registered or whatever, wouldn't you be prepared for that already?
Mr. Dornbach?
Representative Scott, Madam Chair, I'm sure probation and parole would be ready for that to some extent, but when you're dealing with them on a face-to-face basis, that's something you can deal with. I think the other part that was indicated that it's a part of, if it's a felony type offense that we're dealing with, then that person would lose the privilege to have a gun permit. And the court will deal with them on that, but probation parole needs to have authorization that this is what it is, that
okay.
It's been proven.
All right, thank you.
Thank you. Representative Dostkowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Sari, the word defendant, help us understand, so... we would be granting this data to you on a defendant who has not yet been found guilty. Is that correct, or am I off on that?
Madam Chair, Representative Kowalski, I think the reason why the word defendant is there, in that case we're talking about pre-sentence investigation reports, where they have not had a court conviction yet, they've simply pled guilty and are undergoing an investigation by the court. The primary problem that we've had with this is probationers have reported to us that it is very, very common for convicted felons who have gone through the process, completed a pre-sentence investigation report, and been sentenced by the court that don't reveal that they are holders of gun permits, and it's gone through the process and nobody was even aware of it. These people aren't going to admit it on their own. And this access to having that permit thing, it just could be addressed by the court, and it would be clean in their conditions of supervision that they aren't eligible under the conviction of that or a certain offense to hold a permit. So I think the reason why the word defendant is now is because we're talking about the pre-sentence investigation report itself, which is prior to the time they're actually sentenced by the court.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess it's probably the Representative Mullery. I supervise what's called a home confinement program for the county for several years. We'd send agents out to homes to do UAs and test for alcohol and drug use. So they'd have to go out to the homes late at night and enter the homes and do that sort of thing. And that was certainly one of the concerns we had, was whether it was likely that the person was a weapon holder or not, just with respect to concerns of violence and the like. Would this bill also allow then someone, because often we'd send agents out to check perhaps a woman who was on probation and she's living with somebody who was on probation and so forth or on parole, would we be also allowed to check the person who was a partner of the person who we're actually doing the EUA on, do you know?
Representative Mallory?
Madam Chair and Representative Hampton, I don't think so. I think that's my understanding. It would not.
But very good.
Thank you. Any further discussion or question? All right, seeing no. Oh, anybody else in the audience who wishes to testify on the bill? Seeing no further discussion, Representative Mallory renews his motion that House File 497 be passed and referred to the Committee on Public Safety Policy and Oversight. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, say nay. Motion carries.
Thank you.
Okay, the next bill we have for consideration is House File 731. Representative Mallory, would you like to move your bill to get it before the committee?
So moved, Madam Chair. And I'd also like to move the A1 amendment.
All right. Does everyone have a copy of that amendment? Representative Mallory, would you like to move your amendment to get the bill in shape you'd like?
Yes, Madam Chair. So moved.
All in favor of the A1 amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay. Motion carries. All right, Representative Mallory, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And all the amendment does is clean up the language a little. It has the same exact meaning. But staff decided that it was clearer to do it this way. Basically, we have a lot of trouble with trafficking victims for human trafficking, whether it's labor or trafficking, sex trafficking, or other trafficking. And the statute now is not very clear. And so what we're doing is clearing up the statute and also making sure that people are entitled to receive certain money, because it's hard to prove damages in some cases. If you're kept basically as a slave in somebody's basement and they hire you out as a prostitute or something like that, how do you necessarily prove what the loss was? And so there's a minimum amount of damages in this. And also, it makes sure that you can have a year after you're released from the slavery to bring a lawsuit, because obviously if you're kept as a slave in somebody's basement and the statute of limitations ran during that, you weren't really able to get out and go find an attorney and have a lawsuit started. So that clarifies those two. And we have this morning, Madam Chair, from civil society witnesses, if we could have them testify on this.
Yes. Good morning. Welcome to the committee. And please state your name.
Madam Chair, Linda Miller. Madam Chair, Representative, my name is Allison Anastas.
You can proceed.
Madam Chair, Representative, we have a significant problem of human trafficking, which is slavery, human slavery, in Minnesota. The federal government has ranked us as 13th in the nation in terms of numbers of human trafficking victims. That is in large part because of our long border with Canada, which has never had a requirement of visa, and our court, which actually brings in people within the state of Minnesota on ships of foreign flags. because we have a relatively wealthy citizenship, because we have many areas of partially populated areas, such as the Indian Reservation, the cabins, the forests, the lakes, all in which many people can be hidden, trafficking victims can be hidden. And if you look in the packet that I supplied, there's a very interesting map of the state of Minnesota. This is a legislative map. This map shows the second language of school children in the school districts in the state of Minnesota. And if you look on this far corner of the eastern, most north school district, you'll see that the second language spoken by school children is Russian. And if you move west, you see the next one, I think, is Chinese. Then the next one is Hindi. Then the next one is Ukrainian. Then the next one is, Russian. Then the next one is Ukrainian. And then way up here, this is Laotian. This is just an example of how we are very, very lucky to have a diverse citizenship in the state of Minnesota. But also within our state, because of the diversity that we have, there can be hidden easily human trafficking victims. So what I'm saying is, like 15 years ago, it may have been less likely to have a Laotian person way up in this corner. Now it is not. So people can be easily hidden within a state. I'm the executive director of Civil Society, and we have a study in this packet, which is showing the success of our crisis line and our trafficking screening clinics throughout the state. And this study is of 95 of the victims that were referred to us as human trafficking victims. And if you turn to the page one of the pie chart at the bottom, you can see the ethnicities of the people reported to us as human trafficking victims. So you can see that we have a wide group of ethnicities of human trafficking victims. So this is to say that we have a lot of victims we need to help. We have less funding for law enforcement now. So we need another tool, another effective tool to work against the scourge of slavery in our state. California now has started, some attorneys in California have started bringing civil lawsuits against traffickers, human traffickers. And they have been quite successful, sometimes more successful in stopping human trafficking than law enforcement efforts. Finally, we have less funding for services to human trafficking victims and more need. So we need to have a very effective bill which will help our human trafficking victims support themselves by bringing civil lawsuits and have the traffickers pay for what they've done to these victims.
Representative Owen.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. This can go to the author already. It's probably more, the first question. I got two series of questions. The first question is,
And I think the wording might be wrong here, because it says is entitled to a minimum of $20,000 in damages plus punitive. If I can only prove $5,000 damages and you award $20,000, it seems to me you're already into $15,000 punitive. I think it needs to be worded different. Mr. Gehring, can you clarify that?
Madam Chair and Representative Olin, I think the purpose is to have a $20,000, and the punitive damages would be something else. And the reason we have a minimum of $20,000 is because the legislature can determine, and I think that we have the right and should determine that there is damages, whether or not you can, how can you prove what the loss is to somebody for being a slave?
I'm not arguing against that wording. I'm just saying the way it reads now, I think you're into the situation where it's argued. I think it's got to be $20,000, a minimum of $20,000 plus. It's got to be worded somehow differently, because if you can't prove actual damages of $20,000, I think you're already into punitive. I don't know the right wording, but...
Representative Olin, and are you looking at the Amendment A1? It does change the language.
Yes, I am.
Okay.
I'm still not quite sure. I'm convinced I like that wording. It bothers me, and I may be totally wrong in how I'm reading that, but I don't think it reads right.
Madam Chair and Representative Olin, if you're correct, then we will correct it.
Yeah.
On the floor, but I believe that I'm pretty sure that we can do this, because we are setting an amount of damages, and then we're saying a court, for instance, if it's a big business operation, then we want to have the court able to really stick them with punitive damages to where it hurts. Because $20,000 would not hurt a big operation.
We can straighten this part out later. We can straighten this part out later, because I'm just not sure if the wording words right. You don't have to argue with me over what you're trying to do. I know what you're trying to do. I'm just not sure that the wording does exactly what you think.
Okay, we'll...
And I might be reading it wrong.
We'll work with that on probably somebody from the Civil Litigation section of the Bar Association.
But I do have one other series of questions.
Okay, I'll get back to Representative Olin. Representative Jaskowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Mulray and testifiers, it seems like we're putting a big carrot out here almost. Would this setting the $20,000 regardless of the amount of actual damages proved, which as I read it could be zero, or could be $100, or could be $1,000, would that have a propensity for increasing false allegations?
Representative Mulray.
Madam Chair and Representative Drozdowski, I suppose you could say that anything, even giving them the right to sue, would lead to false allegations. However, I think that's obviously up to a court. And if there's a false allegation, obviously there's the same, you can have awards of attorney's fees and damages to some extent against the person making a false accusation in a lawsuit, including against, I don't know if you're not an attorney, may not know, but that can go against the attorney too that brings it.
Representative Jaskowski, you had a follow-up?
Thank you, Madam Chair. So Representative Mulray, if somebody has a claim for false allegations, what do they have to do in order to have those heard in civil court?
Well,
Representative
Madam Chair, Representative Drozdowski, I've never been involved in it, but I know that what you do, I believe you do, is just bring a motion to the court in that same civil matter asking for the court to award that.
Representative Olin?
Thank you, Madam Chairman. This is I don't know if this is so much a question as the fact that part of that border that you're referring to is my district, and I take objection because I know of no case ever coming out of my district on human trafficking. And I have that Lake of the Woods area you refer to, and I know of none up in that area, so I kind of take objection to your referring to all of the Canadian border as just a problem.
Objection noted.
Representative Westrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Maybe Representative Mallory or to the witnesses. Are we talking persons that are here with legal citizenship? Are they illegally in the state? And do we give them now standing to file a lawsuit even though they're legally not even in our state? Or can you clarify that?
Representative Mallory.
First, well, do you want to talk? Okay.
Ms. Astor? Oh, Ms. Miller, either one.
I'm sorry, Representative, what is your name?
Westrom.
Westrom, Representative Westrom. Most of the time, I deal with victims of trafficking. Most of the time, these trafficking victims are lured into the state of Minnesota under false pretenses, perhaps going to the school at the University of Minnesota on student visas, perhaps with a promise of paid work. So, no, they are not legal. They are brought here under the idea that a lot of times that they will be legalized, and they trust their trafficker to get the student visa for them or get the work permit for them. But once they get to the state of Minnesota, they're immediately brought into an unpaid labor or unpaid sex trafficking or some type of situation where they are not free to legalize their status in any way. So no, they are not legal. And at the point where they bring the they escape the trafficker, and they bring a case, find an attorney, it is one of our jobs to make sure that we can get a trafficking visa for them, which would legalize their status here.
Representative Westrom?
So, Madam Chair, what you do, so they don't have legal status, there's a provision called a trafficking visa that then gives them legal status, so they don't get deported in the meantime. Is that how that works? And are we giving them a trafficking visa just for the purpose of filing a lawsuit?
No.
Madam Chair, Representative Weston, the Trafficking Victim Protection Act under the federal government gives them a T visa, which is a temporary visa, to enable us to prosecute the traffickers, so that they are stabilized here in the United States in order to provide evidence against the human traffickers. Otherwise, there cannot be any prosecution of human traffickers.
Okay, Madam Chair.
Representative Weston.
So what happens after the trial then? Do they go back to their country of origin, or do they just give them a free pass to stay?
Madam Chair, Representative Weston. Some go back to their own country, some stay here.
And Madam Chair,
Representative Weston,
they stay here, they go through the normal citizenship process then? Is that what they do? And one more question after this, Madam Chair.
Ms. Miller.
Yes, Madam Chair, Representative Weston, some of them, the ones that stay here, do go through a normal citizenship process.
Representative Weston, your last question?
Madam Chair, maybe I'll just move. Well, first of all, is there anybody objecting to this, or what's? I'm just trying to figure out who we're going to be putting in this condition, and is it is widespread, how big of a problem is this? Maybe that's the question I should just ask. I mean,
Ms. Miller,
about the hundreds, 500, thousands.
Have you heard from the traffickers' lobbyists at all? Ms. Miller.
The slave owners, Madam Chair, have a big lobby here.
Madam Chair, Representative Weston, the numbers are incredible. It is supposed to be the second most economically viable illegal activity in the world, with 14,500 to 17,500 of international human trafficking victims being brought into the United States every year.
Thanks.
Representative Gostkowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just following up on the thread that Representative Westrum had asked, is there anything about the court proceedings dealing with an allegation of human trafficking that provides additional opportunity for someone who is not of legal status here to then become of legal status permanently?
Ms. Miller.
Madam Chair, Representative Gostkowski, no. The criminal, so the person that the suit would be brought against is a person who has been, who is found to be in violation of the sex trafficking law, the labor trafficking law, or taking people's documents. Taking people's legal documents are the 609.2828. So that's the person that the suit is being brought against, and the person that is bringing the suit is the trafficking victim of that trafficking.
Representative Westrum.
Did I hear correctly one of the statements earlier made was that you're going through a list of all the different languages. Can you repeat, is that kind of a barrier for several of them, or what was the point you were trying to make there?
Ms. Miller.
Madam Chair, Representative Westrum, I was just showing the length and the depth of this problem in the state of Minnesota. I was just trying to illustrate the depth of the problem in that these are the ethnicities of the people that are within our state that have been reported to be human trafficking victims.
Madam Speaker, I don't recall you saying in the English speaking, is there, you think the language they speak or the country they come from is indicative of the problem, or is that a barrier when they get here and they're not able to speak the language? Is that part of what's causing this to happen, do you think?
Ms. Miller.
Madam Chair, Representative Westrum, the language is a significant barrier for them. Also the fact that they don't know our culture, they don't know that we have shelters, they don't know people here, they don't know their doctors, they don't know a nurse or anyone that they can report this to.
Thanks.
Any further discussion? Representative Gostkowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Miller, is it? Thank you. The definition of victims, can you help us a little bit with that? And I'm looking at page 2 of your document here, and it says that that civil society found 35 victims within a 3-year period, so about 11 and a half or something like that a year. Those victims were there alleged perpetrators found guilty criminally, and were they sued civilly? Can you give us a little bit on that?
Ms. Miller.
Madam Chair, Representative Gostkowski, 35 of the victims came to civil society through our trafficking screening clinic. 19 people found to be trafficking victims came to us through law enforcement. The ones that came to us through law enforcement, the traffickers have all been found guilty. And they have been sentenced the one bust on May 19th, 2007, it was in federal criminal court. 27 of them were indicted, 25 were found. two are still on the loose. All of the 27 have pled guilty. All of the 25 have pled guilty. Then there's been, since that time, before that time there was one bust. After that time there's been about seven busts. As a result of those busts, there have been additional human trafficking victims found guilty. And
Representative Jaskowski.
So Ms. Miller, I'm wanting to get an accurate depiction of the word victim here. Mm-hmm. Are they a victim when they come to your office because they've been referred, and I don't understand how your screening clinics work, or are they a victim after the alleged perpetrators have been proved guilty?
Ms. Miller.
Madam Chair, Representative Jaskowski. They are found to, what we're saying is a victim. When we say the 35 victims and the 17 victims, they were all determined to be human trafficking victims under the federal statute, the Trafficking Victim Protection Act. All of those victims' cases were given to the United States Department of Justice, and they have been accepted as victims. The 17 that the police brought to us have had their traffickers convicted. The others have.
Representative Jaskowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Last question here, Ms. Miller. So what you said is that through the federal law and the federal process, some people are actually called victims before it's proven that the alleged perpetrators are guilty of what they're being accused of. Is that correct?
Ms. Miller.
Madam Chair, Representative Jaskowski. Yes, it is true, because obviously you need to have witnesses testifying at the traffickers' trials. So you have what they're called pre-certified under the federal law, and that means that we haven't done all the federal processes yet, because we have to keep them safe and we have to get them psychologically well and prepared to testify against the traffickers at the trial, and that sometimes takes, in this case, all of the ones we've caught pled guilty, but if there is a trial, sometimes it's 2 years, 3 years.
Representative Holberg. Thank you, Madam Chair, and maybe this might help. In looking at your document, you start out on the first page talking about case files of 95 victims. And then on your next page, you start putting them into categories. So would it be more accurate to maybe say you had 95 clients or 95 referrals? And then were all of the 95, were they all in fact, they probably all were all in fact some type of victim, but victims of trafficking, maybe not.
And
there's
no. Yes, Madam Chair, Representative Holbert, that's exactly correct. That we're analyzing in a certain time period how many people were referred to us through the Trafficking Victim Protection, through the screening clinic or the crisis line. And some of them we determined were victims, and some of them we didn't. And that's the first pie chart here. If you look at the first pie chart on page one, you see that the red is the victim screened and found not to meet the federal statute. The blue is the victim screened who were found to meet the federal statute. The green is the victim screen, and we were unable to make a determination because perhaps they were psychologically mentally ill and therefore can't testify or some other reason. And then the purple is the ones that the law enforcement brought to us. And the light blue, and they were found to be trafficking victims, and the light blue are the victims who the law enforcement brought to us but were found not to be human trafficking victims.
Okay, and Madam Chair, if I might, I'm assuming
yes,
that
Representative Holbert.
All of your charts have drafts not for distribution still on them. I'm assuming that maybe that's not the case, that this is for distribution and it's no longer a draft.
I was told that was an easy way of putting to alerting people that we may want to revise this. For instance, if we want to now include the victims that we've received since the 95.
I'm trying to respect your wishes. Maybe it might be more advantageous for you to put as of a certain date, because if this is telling me not for distribution, I mean, can I use this? I mean, I'm assuming that I can use it and give it to other people and talk about this issue, but there might be a better way of accomplishing what you're trying to do by maybe dating these or something, as opposed to saying that it's draft and not for distribution. That kind of gives a picture that maybe it isn't final or completely reviewed.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Right.
Madam Chair, Representative Holbrook, I greatly appreciate your suggestion.
Representative Kelly.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and for Chair Mulray or the testifier. Just curious where the $20,000 figure came from and how we came to that one.
Representative Mulray.
Madam Chair and Representative Kelly, obviously, there's no huge research goes into that. It was just a figure that we came up with to you're trying to have a general estimate, and that's obviously impossible. But we want it serious enough to be the actual damages. Not the punitive is a different type of an issue. And so there's no empirical study to come up with the $20,000.
Representative Mulray, can you just confirm that right now there is currently a civil cause of action on the books under Section 609.284 sub 2, and that this just puts that dollar figure on it?
Well,
so this is not a new cause of action.
Madam Chair, it's not a new cause of action, but the old language was very cumbersome and was almost impossible to deal with. And so that's why that statute being repealed and this one put in place of it.
One other question, and that is, can I assume that for the victim to prevail in court, there has to be a court finding that the defendant violated the trafficking sections referred to?
Madam Chair, obviously, yes. It says they have to show that they were the violation of one of those three statutes.
Thank you. Representative Olin.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. There's some confusion going on here, and if this bill is going to LaFleur next, I don't think it's ready to go there yet until there's some discussion on a few things that are bothering people, and I'm going to move to table the bill for a future date.
Representative Mulray, what would you like to do?
Madam Chair, obviously I don't think it should be tabled. I think the bill is ready to go to the floor. I don't understand any questions about it, but there's a motion, so Chair has to entertain the motion.
Okay. Does anyone want to discuss the motion to table?
Debatable.
Madam Chair, point of order. Madam Chair, I don't believe that motion is debatable.
Thank you, Representative Dresden. I consider myself educated. All right. All those in favor of Representative Olin's motion to table signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. No.
No.
Division, Madam Chair. Division.
Okay. Those in favor of the motion to table, please raise your hand. I see there are four. Those against the motion to table, please raise your hand. And the motion fails.
Close the count.
I'm sure there was a nay count.
6-4. Madam Chair, Representative Holbert, I didn't vote on the motion to table because I think tabling it, we wouldn't have been able to discuss it. I don't think this bill is ready to go to the floor either, but we do still have some time in here in committee. In looking at this, I'm curious, why did you choose, though not later than 1 year from the date the trafficking victim bringing action is free from the traffickers, and does that, most of the time in the discussion around, especially in the area of sexual abuse or, I'm assuming a lot of these trafficking situations involve sexual abuse, there's usually a necessary time period of trying to get your feet back underneath you, and 1 year from the time you escape the situation may not be enough time for somebody to get to a point where they'd be able to move forward and testify and, you know, have the whole case together. So that's one of my concerns. The other issue is I don't know how it interacts with the statute of limitations on just sexual abuse crimes. And so maybe Mr. Gearing can help on that. It would be two separate court cases or... So is the net effect of this is passed the way it is that within a year you'd have to file for trafficking, but that you'd still have, I think, is it 7 years for sexual abuse? Is that how this would work? And could you go back again? Or how will that, those two issues work with each other?
Mr. Chair, Representative Holbrook, I think that they would be two separate issues. This is establishing a unique individual cause of action with its own statute of limitations period. So if the victim could show that they had that they met the elements of a different cause of action, then they could sue under that cause of action based on whatever that limitations period would be. So there potentially could be two suits depending on the facts of the case.
And if I might, I'm getting into deep water here where I probably shouldn't go, not being an attorney, but if you present evidence, say you decide you have to move within a year on the trafficking issue, so you get what you can together and move on that, then is all of the information presented and all the testimony by the defendant, et cetera, is that all admissible in a subsequent case for sexual abuse? Or can the information that the trafficker would present in a trafficking case, is that then not admissible in a later case for sexual abuse? Representative Mueller, I guess these are evidentiary rule questions.
Madam Chair, I believe, Representative Holbrook, I believe that the testimony in court would then be admissible in the other proceeding. I'm pretty sure. Does anybody? Madam Chair, I think, I'm not sure, Mr. Gearing's grabbing the rules of the evidence book. It's going to be pretty hard to find it in a short minute. I believe that's the case, Representative Holder.
Representative Hortman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think that there's a couple things that we could do to fix this bill that would make it ready to go to the floor. I know I was arrived late, and it sounds like there wasn't a lot of discussion about the A1 amendment. I'll tell you, the portion of the bill, the proposed bill that makes me uncomfortable is the minimum of $20,000 in damages regardless of what's proved. And this is a very unique kind of situation, creating civil liability for criminal wrong, because we have personal injury law that does cover similar, I mean, if there's an assault, you know, there is a cause of action already. But another similar area of law where we create some civil liability for a victim are victims of discrimination. And in those cases, the actual harm is very difficult to prove. It's very difficult to prove what are the damages of being discriminated against. Similarly here, you know, you might have a psychologist or a psychiatrist be able to testify to the mental suffering, which would help establish damages in a normal personal injury case. But I can understand the reason of trying to come up with a set figure, because it is really a horrific crime. But it doesn't mean that in every situation the $20,000 is going to be the appropriate remedy or penalty. And that is sort of in the nature of a punitive damages. So I don't know, you know, it's really up to the author what he wants to do with his bill. But in my opinion, if we were to move to reconsider the A1 amendment and take it off, and then delete the language on line 1.9 after the period, and going through halfway through line 1.12, we get rid of that minimum of $20,000 in damages, and we could insert in its place a civil penalty like we have under the Human Rights Act. And actually, of course, maybe sexual trafficking victims probably have a cause of action under the Human Rights Act and federal anti-discrimination laws. But a civil penalty is something then that's in the discretion of the judge. It's in the nature of punitive damages, but it has a different level of proof. I don't know if that fixes it up in people's opinion. If people like that direction, depending upon what the author wants to do, I would make that motion.
Okay. Representative Mallory.
Well, Madam Chair,
Madam Chair, Representative Mallory, just to be clear, it leaves in the possibility of punitive damages that currently exists at line 1.8 and 1.9. It would just leave that to the normal, I think it's, you know, Minnesota Statute 549.21 standard for punitive damages.
Representative Olin.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Just a quick comment. The reason I moved the table is that wording is the wording that I would have to vote no against it in its present form, because at 20 it seems overlapped and punitive. I can support damages plus punitive damages, reasonable costs and reasonable attorney fees, etc., but I can't support giving a $20,000 number in the bill.
Representative Mallory.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, the two witnesses have extensively discussed it, and they think it's better the way it is.
Madam Chair.
Representative Hartman.
Then I would move that what we do is we send the bill without recommendation to the Committee on Crime Victims and let the author continue to work with members and with his advocates to improve the bill before it gets to the floor.
Representative Mallory, would you be amenable to that?
Madam Chair, I guess so at this point.
Okay, thank you. Then, all in favor of Representative Hartman's motion, would you repeat that for me?
When we get to the voting on the bill, I would propose that we send it to the Committee on Crime Victims without recommendation.
Okay. Madam Chair? Representative Holbert.
You know, I know that people want to move bills along, and I can appreciate that the bill author would like that, but this is a civil law committee, and these are civil issues. And, you know, if this committee continues to just give up its authority and its job and send stuff along with civil issues not resolved, I don't think that that's what we should be doing as a committee. And, I mean, I want some resolution to this issue. I think, in general, it's a good idea, but I think there's far more questions. It would be nice if the bill author would voluntarily lay it over and work with some of us in getting some of this cleaned up before it leaves this committee, which is his committee. He's got pretty much total control of when it comes back up on the agenda. It's his bill. But from my perspective, there's way too many questions, and we're going to send civil issue questions off to the crime committee, and I just don't think that we as a committee should be doing that.
Representative Mallory, and I'd like to remind the committee, we still have 20 minutes to ask questions, discuss, make recommendations. Representative Mallory.
And Madam Chair, to the last point of Representative Holberg, the I can't think of the whole name of Representative Lesh committee, but it has a lot of civil law bills in there, so it's not necessarily the quotes crime committee. In fact, I don't know, maybe Chair Hilstrom knows the whole name of legislation under her, but it's about eight words, I believe.
Yes, Madam Chair. One minute, Representative Hilstrom. Representative Kelly.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question regarding the question on $20,000, just because it seems so arbitrary, I thought Representative Portman's amendment was a fantastic idea, because it sounds like that's where all the confusion is, and to leave that up to the judge, I think makes a lot of sense. I would ask you to reconsider Representative Portman's amendment.
Representative Mallory?
Well, Madam Chair and Representative Kelly, the witnesses discussed that and felt that it was better this way, but we can work that out with Representative Hortman's motion, and we can work that out and work it out with some other people before it goes to Representative Lesh, or before it's heard in Representative Lesh's committee.
Representative Hilstrom?
Thank you, Madam Chair. In the event that it's going to go to Representative Lesh's committee, it should be referred to my committee, the Public Safety Policy Oversight Committee, with a recommended re-referral to the Crime Victims Subcommittee, Crime Victims and Data Practices Subdivision. And Criminal Records, yes.
All right. Thank you, Representative Western.
Well, Madam Chair, any one of us could also move Representative Hortman's proposed amendment. It seems like that ought to be what we should do. We've got 15 minutes left. Representative Mallory, the witnesses don't want it. They aren't the legislature. That's part of the reason we go through committee, is to modify things as we see different concerns. And so I won't offer it right now. I'd encourage somebody to offer the amendment, and if nobody else does, I'll ask staff to review that proposal, and I'll offer the amendment, but there might be somebody else that does otherwise.
Okay. Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Holbert, I think you're right. This is a civil law committee, and the author of the bill is the chairman of the committee. The author of the bill can bring this bill back up at any time at his discretion, and it might be better served to bring it back up in this particular committee so that the author has the ability to shape the bill a little bit easier and better. So I'm just a suggestion to the author of the bill.
Do you wish to respond, Representative Mahoney?
Well, Madam Chair, we still have, if there's if somebody has a point or an issue, it can if somebody has a specific amendment that can be discussed here, we've got 15 minutes.
That we do. Representative Olin.
Thank you, Madam Chairman, and I would like to move the partner amendments and have Mr. Gehring or try to review it, because I think that's where a lot of concerns are.
Okay. The motion then is to reconsider the A1 amendment. And discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed by nay. Motion fails. Now, is there a motion to amend the House File 731 in its original form?
Madam Chair, I think we now have to vote on whether or not to take off. Where we move to reconsider, now I think we have to move to take it off. If that's the first step of getting to what Representative Hartman proposed.
All right, then. Okay. Representative Holbrook, are you then moving to take off the A1 amendment?
Yes, sir.
All right. Discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed, same sign. Okay. Now we're back to the original form. Okay, so now we're back to House File 731 in its original form prior to the A1 amendment.
Madam Chair, I would move that we delete on line 1.9 after the period and through line 1.12 up to the period.
So do I understand the motion?
Just for the record, can you just read what we're deleting?
Madam Chair, the amendment is to delete everything after the period on line 1.9, delete line 1.10, 1.11, and everything through the period on line 1.12. So the language that's being deleted currently reads, a victim who prevails in an action brought under this section is entitled to a minimum of $20,000 in damages, regardless of the amount of actual damages proved, plus costs, disbursements, punitive damages, and reasonable attorney's fees.
Representative Owen.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. And just for the record, it still does include the wording, the court may award damages, including punitive damages, reasonable attorney's fees, and other reasonable litigation costs, because that was in the clause before. So that still allows that procedure. So it doesn't have a $20,000 number.
Representative Hartman, the civil penalties, that's just built into law and doesn't need to be, as we stated,
Madam Chair, my suggestion was we consider, if Representative Mulry wanted to, the addition of a civil penalty. If he wanted to make this parallel to existing law and the Human Rights Act, we don't need to add a civil penalty. I think we should just move the deletion, and then it's really up to him if he wants to try to craft that language.
Okay. Any more discussion on the deletion? Hearing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Representative Mulry, do you have any wishes regarding language for a civil penalty?
Madam Chair, I guess at this point I would ask the chair to entertain the idea of the chair laying over the bill.
Okay. If that's your desire, then this this bill's laid over.
And Madam Chair, if I might, I'd like someone in the, before it comes back up, to look at this issue of the statute of limitations, the 1 year, and how that interacts with other causes of action that a victim might have, and try and get, I mean, 1 year to me seems pretty quick if somebody suffered a lot of trauma.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if there's a way to look at that, but I'd like to have some discussion around that issue when this bill comes back up, and know whether or not there's a conflict between filing sexual abuse and whether you have two separate court cases in two different years, or how all that would work, so that we understand what constraints we're putting on these victims as far as what choices they'll have to make and what time frame.
Thank you, Representative Holbert. I would like some clarity, that not that it needs to be in the bill, just for my own edification, about victims who are underage and if there is a delay in the statute of limitations. Because, and maybe that's already set forth, but I don't know how that works, and I'd like to.
Well,
thank you, Madam Chair. Just following up on Representative Holberg's comments, Representative Mulry, just a request to ask if we could get any amendments, maybe a day ahead of time or something, 24 hours, something like that. Any lead time would be appreciated.
Madam Chair, we'll try and do that. The one today was just restating what was already in there, so that was nothing new in it. But I'm trying to work out whatever is these questions. If there's some amendments, we'll try to do that.
If there's nothing else, then this committee stands adjourned.